On March 25th, 2010, I led a panel on LGBTQ youth homelessness at the Rainbow Health Ontario Conference at the Marriott Hotel in Toronto. This episode of my podcast is a recording of that panel presentation. On the panel, you will hear myself, Ilona Abramovich, Michelle LeClaire from the 519, and Lorraine Barnaby from Shout Clinic. The presentation focuses on the experiences of LGBTQ youth who are homeless in a city that essentially offers very little support, the barriers to support, and possible recommendations to existing services. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us today at our discussion entitled LGBTQ Youth Homelessness in Toronto, Where's the Support? I think it's really important that we speak about homelessness at this conference here today. So we're really happy to be here talking about this issue. I'd like to just provide a brief outline as to what you can expect for the next 90 minutes or so. First of all, I'm going to be providing some background information on LGBTQ youth homelessness in Toronto. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the research that I did for my master's, as well as the research that I'm going to be doing for my PhD. And then I'm going to share a short film that I created. After me, Michelle is going to share some of her lived experiences, as well as discuss the reasons that trans youth become homeless and some of the barriers that LGBTQ youth, homeless youth face in the shelter system. And then Lorraine's going to be discussing some of the findings from the Shout Clinic Harm Reduction Report 2010, a recent study that she conducted. And then after we've all presented, we're going to be dividing you into small groups, and we're going to engage in a group exercise. And then you're going to have some time to share some of the main points that you discussed with your groups, as well as to ask any questions that you might have. Okay, so the main purpose of our presentation is to help raise awareness to the issues of LGBTQ youth homelessness in Toronto and the lack of support available. We truly hope that our presentation will not only educate, but will also inspire new ideas for strategies that can lead to solutions and support for LGBTQ youth who are homeless in Toronto. I'd just like to start off by locating myself in this work and sharing with you how I came to be so passionate about finding where the support is for LGBTQ youth who are homeless in Toronto. So having grown up in Toronto, I've always been interested in the issues of homelessness. And because I had a very traumatic coming out experience, I quickly learned how easy it is to become homeless. And I became interested in the relationship between being queer and homelessness. Queer youth face huge amounts of discrimination and harassment and make up a large proportion of the homeless youth population in Toronto. LGBTQ youth are overrepresented in the homeless population. It has been estimated that approximately 20 to 40% of homeless youth are LGBTQ. However, in Toronto, there are no specialized emergency crisis shelters for LGBTQ youth. A recent Toronto-based study identified that the homeless LGBTQ youth population has been increasing and that agencies serving homeless youth have reported challenges in providing support to LGBTQ youth. Only a small number of studies have actually looked at the perspectives of LGBTQ youth who have experienced homelessness in Toronto. So I don't think that enough people have a true understanding of the complexities of what coming out entails. I don't think that there's enough conversation or connection around the fact that we still live in a very homophobic society. And we also live in a society where there's a very obvious homelessness crisis, and the two are so intertwined. So all of this led me to my master's thesis, which was entitled Young, Queer, and Homeless in Toronto, Where's the Support?, which I completed in September 2008 at York University in the Critical Disability Studies program. For this project, I interviewed 5 queer homeless youth through Shout Clinic, a community-based healthcare clinic in Toronto. I also interviewed 5 staff members from various support services for homeless youth, including Covenant House, Evergreen, Soy, and Shout Clinic. So the main purpose of these interviews was to find out where the support is for queer youth who are homeless in Toronto, as well as to find out what sorts of barriers they face when trying to access services, and of course, find out more about their needs from such services. I also wanted to give youth an opportunity to share their lived experiences and to have their important voices heard. So in reviewing the literature in this field, I found minimal studies coming out of Canada that focus on the needs, barriers, and challenges of queer homeless youth. The main finding of this research study revealed that there is minimal support for queer youth who are homeless in Toronto, and that the shelter system is in fact a very homophobic place. Some youth spoke about the fact that they feel safer sleeping on a park bench than they do in the shelter system. Staff also discussed the need for more training around the issues of coming out and homophobia. All of the youth I interviewed had come to Toronto from various locations because of its gay-friendly reputation and because they thought that they would find support in the city. However, ironically, there was consensus among the youth participants that support services place automatic assumptions on homeless youth that make it hard to come out and to feel safe in support services. One youth stated, "We're not cookie cutter. Even those of us who are as queer as a $3 bill aren't the same as the next gay kid." Another youth stated, "Not to assume things so much. A lot of places do assume that just because you're actually going in there, that you're gay and you're positive. So not to label somebody with something which, you know, could cause them or their personal safety to be diminished, basically." So the youth reported frequent incidences of homophobia in the shelter system and in support services such as drop-ins. One participant who had stayed in several shelters in Toronto discussed having to deal with homophobia both from staff and from other youth attending services. He stated that he refused to go to several support services in Toronto because the client base is extremely homophobic. He stated, "I was helping serving lunch on the Sunday, and afterwards, I went and talked to the staff to get my chore, and the youth came up, stood right beside me full force, not even trying to hide. He said to the staff, 'A faggot shouldn't be serving food here.'" One youth participant spoke about having to deal with homophobia in every single place that he has lived. He stated, "I'm very picky about the shelters I go to because of being gay and because of my experiences." The staff members I spoke to also acknowledged the high rate of homophobia that occurs in the shelter system. For example, one staff member from Evergreen stated, "Queer youth get beat up a lot and it's very hard." So when asked to describe what safe and helpful services would look like, youth stated that it would be a place where people can understand and respect what youth are going through and not place judgments on them. You know, in something like this, you need somebody who really understands you and really wants to help you. Youth stated that although there is a large gap in support services for LGBTQ homeless youth, they tend to find the most support from services with a specific focus on the queer youth population and from community-based organizations that offer a wide range of programs and services. They also stated that they have caution around faith-based organizations, and they use them as a last resort because there tends to be stronger associations of homophobia associated with those types of services. Several staff members that I spoke to recognized the importance for both staff and organizations to take the lead in really committing to making sure that there is consistency in stopping homophobic slurs and violence from occurring each and every time, as well as making sure that the service's space reveals its values from what's up on the walls to the actions of the staff members. A staff member stated, "It's about how you create a welcoming space. Do you have posters up on your wall that say we're queer positive?" So one of the primary recommendations that emerged from this study was the need for Toronto to implement an emergency crisis shelter specifically for LGBTQ youth. An emergency crisis shelter for LGBTQ youth would provide safety for a large proportion of youth who have been forced out of their homes, abused, or discriminated against. Although a shelter may not be the solution, it would definitely be an emergency response to dealing with an emergency situation. One youth stated, "They need a gay shelter, they do, because gay youth are all over the city in shelters. I think they need a strictly gay shelter that is run by gay staff to make the youth feel more comfortable." Other recommendations included that existing services need to begin implementing queer-focused programs, and that more intensive anti-homophobia training is needed for staff, and for staff to become committed to discouraging homophobic behavior at all times in services. The study also highlighted the need for future research to concentrate on this population and to include the voices of youth themselves. So I've recently started the second phase of this research project by beginning my PhD, and I've come forward with a question in mind. And the question that I'm asking is, what changes need to be implemented in the current shelter system in order for it to become safe, accessible, and supportive for LGBTQ youth who are homeless? Some relevant questions that I'm going to be looking at and I hope to answer include, what kind of specialized services are needed for this community? What kind of staff training is needed in the shelter system in order to serve all youth properly and to deal with situations of homophobia and transphobia? and what underpins and recreates the current problems and barriers that LGBTQ youth face in the shelter system? And what impact does the lack of support in the shelter system have on the populations already high risk for HIV/AIDS and other health concerns? So I've already started the first phase of this research project, which actually had a bit of a rocky start. I had proposed to conduct three focus groups, three group interviews, in three different shelters with non-managerial frontline staff to explore the anti-oppression training that staff members received and their levels of preparedness in dealing with situations of homophobia and transphobia in the shelter system. However, I had no luck with any of the shelters in Toronto. One shelter told me that they had no time, which I found really hard to believe because really I was only asking for about an hour to an hour and a half of their time in total. Another shelter stated that their staff was not interested and they just left it at that. And then another shelter made it virtually impossible for my focus group to happen in their shelter. So the responses that I received definitely raised a lot of questions. It seems to me that shelters either know that there are problems with the anti-oppression training or lack of training that staff members are receiving, or there may be fear around what types of findings would come up from a study like this in terms of not only training, but in terms of staff's levels of preparedness in dealing with situations of homophobia and transphobia. So luckily, a shelter in Newmarket contacted me, and they were interested in my research. So I was able to conduct one focus group with their staff in Newmarket. I'm currently in the stage of analyzing the data, but some of the preliminary findings indicate that there is a large gap in the anti-homophobia training that the staff members who I spoke to received. They indicated they had minimal knowledge around LGBTQ culture and terminology, and highlighted the need for training that would provide some insider knowledge. So one participant stated, "I remember going to someone and saying, is that seriously okay to use? But that's what they identify as. If they identify as queer, then they're okay with queer." They also stated that the majority of homophobia that occurs in the shelter exists between youth, rather than from staff. And that some staff participants believe that youth sometimes use the term homophobia as a way of protecting themselves. So that participant stated, "I've seen something here where they started an altercation, but it wasn't because he's a gay or he's a something different orientation, where they were fighting with each other. That was about something else. But this is a way to protect themselves. Oh, because I'm gay, he's attacking me. It's not true. No, it's not true in any cases, no." So a big part of this project will be looking at how key institutional documents by which shelters run cause the problems and barriers that LGBTQ youth experience. So I'm going to be looking at how the problems faced by youth arise from the institution and cannot be solved by youth themselves, but rather from within the institution. Approximately 20 to 30 LGBTQ youth will be interviewed and will be asked to share their experiences of how the shelter system has let them down and the kinds of problems and barriers that they have run into in the shelter system. So a big part of the work that I do involves arts-informed research. So this project will involve a digital storytelling photo voice project with a group of youth of approximately 5 LGBTQ youth who are or have had experiences of homelessness. Each youth will get a point-and-shoot camera and will be asked to take both still photos and moving footage of where they find support from a system that essentially offers no support, as well as the representation of homophobia and transphobia that they've experienced. Together with the youth, we will use all the footage to create a short film. So this research project will illuminate the complexities, barriers, and needs of LGBTQ homeless youth in Toronto. With this knowledge, it'll be possible to develop a plan of action that will improve the shelter system and support services so that the necessary and appropriate support is actually available. This research will offer distinctive contributions to not only homelessness scholarship, but to education on homelessness more broadly, and to foster activism for social change. It's very important for me to be authentic as a researcher in the work that I do, and to be true to my work. And I know that I can't ask people to do something that I myself have not done. So what I've done is I've created a video of where I found support when I came out to my family approximately 9 years ago. I'm going to be using this video to share with the youth who I'm going to be working on the Arts Informed project with, just so we sort of start off on the same page. And I'd like to share this video with you right now. Great, thanks. So we're going to continue with Michelle.
I think I need a moment.
I know, I thought, I don't want to follow that.
So good morning, everyone. My name is Michelle LeClaire, and one of the other presenters for this workshop. So I've been debating a lot about how I should speak to folks about my lived experience as well and how I want to present things. And this is my style of communication. This is my style of presentation. My experiences with being homeless and also working within the shelter system and working with marginalized communities, I've really learned that this is the way that people communicate and support each other. And I want to also take a second to acknowledge the fact that I'm in this space here and I'm very privileged to be here, and that there are a lot of other people that that I know personally that may not even have had the opportunity to experience education the way I have, to find community the way I have, and to even be a presenter at workshops to tell their stories. I also want to say that in no way do I represent the trans community. I don't speak for trans men. I don't speak for all homeless people. I'm going to share my unique story, like everyone has a unique story, and I think that's important to keep in mind. And I'm really glad that I'm able to share that with you. So with that disclaimer out of the way, I just want to share a very brief summary of my roughly 6 years of chronic homelessness and in and out of being home housed. So dealing with issues of gender identity throughout my age as a teen was a problem. Grew up in a Roman Catholic family, Italian and Polish. Small town, Calvinese from Peel region. Went to a Catholic high school. Had a pretty privileged life, grew up in a pretty white, privileged community. Coming out as trans, my parents was problematic, and they didn't take it very well. As time went on, threats of homelessness became more prevalent. Physical abuse, verbal abuse kept escalating. And coming from a small rural town, there wasn't very many places to go, so I actually refused to leave, despite physical abuse and all these things going on. It's also important to know that I wasn't out to anyone, because there was no positive literature. There was very little understanding for even myself to understand my identity, so I kept it from my family, kept it from my friends, kept it from everyone. This ended up in creating a catastrophic collapse of my housing when my parents finally kicked me out and I refused to leave, and then they called the cops and the cops forced me to leave. And I had actually a real terrible experience with the Peel police. I wasn't allowed to take any of my clothes with me. So I did what I could. I might cry. I'm actually going to cry. But I went to the town. I used a payphone, called my friend. I'm like, hey, I'm homeless. Like, I don't have a place to go. And out there, your friends are 40 minutes away by car. So over the next 6 years, I for 2 to 3 weeks to 4 months at a time, would spend it with my partner, my girlfriend, my best friends. My English teacher at one point actually housed me, which is really great. But it all translated to one key missing piece in my life, which was community, which was support through health services, which was support through education. The end result was a massive migration to Toronto. Why? Because in Toronto, I can rent a room for $350 a month. Because in Toronto, I can find people who can serve my medical needs, who can serve my social needs, and I can find stability. So in the end, after being chronically homeless throughout high school, I made that transition to Toronto, and it wasn't easy. But I'm a stubborn person, and I attribute that to the success I have today. Because it's allowed me to say, well, no, you don't want me to live mom and dad. You tell me you want me to commit suicide. Well, as a rebel, I'm not going to die so that you can be miserable, and I can be successful and continue to cause you misery because you don't like me and don't want me in your life. And so that became my driving force behind being like, you know what? No, I'm trans, I'm queer, and I want an education, I want a future, I want to have a partner, I want what a lot of privileged people have. And so I stayed hard and fast to it. I was lucky enough to come to the 519 because I heard that there were groups going on. And let me tell you, it was very interesting going on the subway for the first time from Yorkdale to the 519 as a visible trans person. Being taken as a drag queen was very interesting. But I think I scared more people than I was afraid of them, which is kind of empowering. and, you know, so at the time I was like, oh, I don't care. They can think I'm a drag queen. It's all good. So I came to the 519. I found TransUtrona. I found a group where there were other youth who were experiencing homelessness, experiencing loss of income, experiencing social isolation. And it was great to be able to air it out. And it wasn't even necessarily a support group. We could talk about anything. We played PlayStation. We did different activities. But it was really great. And then sooner or later, you know, I hooked up with the Fred Victor Center, which had an employment program for trans people. And I ended up working there. I got my first job from Kirsten Schmidt-Chamberlain, who knows her. So I have to credit her. This was a critical intervention for me because it was the first time as an out trans woman that I was gaining real lived experience working in a traditional workplace under my new identity in a supportive role in which I could actually use this on a resume, because you have to keep in mind, up until this point, the whole world knew me as X, and now I was X.2. You know, I was a new person, a new identity, and a lot of my documents had not been changed over, and my name wasn't recognized by the provincial government or, you know, any of that. So it's really hard when you're like, you go to an employer and you're like, I have all these skills, but I can't give you any references, so just believe me. I can get it done. But I can't really give you any background information about how I got these skills. So that's a bit about my story. And I've been really fortunate. I am going to credit the people that have been in my life. Claire Knobs, Kyle Scanlon, Kirsten Schmidt-Chamberlain, Holden Keyes. These people were great. Nicole and his mom, if anyone knows River Raj. So, you know, it actually elevated me to the point where I could get an education. It helped me hook up with those people, you know, told me about George Brown having more inclusive trans and queer environment. And, you know, I actually got through my social service worker program. And before I knew it, I started to take on more of an activist role as a trans person, an out trans person. I ran in the elections for student government. I was vice president for 2 years. An openly queer and trans woman, and that was really empowering. And, you know, here I am now, work for Eva Sala, and I'm the trans community services coordinator for the 519, which is kind of scary when everyone's like, so Michelle, can you tell us how to do things right? Maybe I can give you suggestions. So, all right, let's go into some of the reasons why trans youth can become homeless. So the first things I want to talk about is that there's a lack of public education around trans identities in terms of the struggles that they face, how to support them, their particular needs. There's a lack of visibility, positive media reflection of trans people. I mean, up until the point of when I came to Toronto, my only interaction with trans people was through Jerry Springer or The Murray Show, being like, guess who's the man? Which is ridiculous. And the fact is that I had no idea that trans men existed, but of course they do. But of course, when you grow up in a small town and there's nothing in literature, there's nothing in the education system, there's nothing within your religion, there's nothing within small towns that supports inclusion of trans people and their identities, do you learn about that? So that has a compounding effect, right? It fosters an environment of social isolation because people have a fear of coming out. They don't know who they can feel comfortable around. They don't really know if a program's gonna meet their needs. And so a lot of the time it just becomes, well, you know, I'm not gonna deal with that because it's very emotional, it's very hard to deal with. There's the rejection of family and community and culture and religion that comes as a consequence of all these things. And so as a youth, what are you to do? Housing is expensive, especially in Ontario. I mean, right now, me and my partner are looking at homes in Florida you can buy for $100,000. When a condo here costs $700,000, and in the suburbs is $500,000. And where I grew up in a small town, the rental units were roughly about $1,200 a month. So where can you go? And so you come to Toronto, which is also a health concern because there's this migration aspect. You're leaving your culture, you're leaving your friends, you're leaving your family. And that has ripple effects. It builds upon social isolation. Mental health issues can be increased or become prevalent because of these factors. You can experience things like depression, anxiety, some of the things I still to this day experience. And then there's the challenges of employment as a trans person. So first off, not having your identity recognized, not being able to talk about references to other people, workplace environments not having trans inclusion policies or being trans supportive or trans aware. There's this idea that no matter who you are, you can find work. When you're a trans person, that's extremely hard unless you have people that are going to back you up to say, yeah, you know, I know this person and they have this experience or even just get a job, because it can be very difficult as a trans person to get a job. And so how do you gain housing? You need to pay for first and last. You need to show pay stubs. And this becomes particularly a problem for people whose occupation is sex work. So irregardless of people's views around sex work, the 519 views it as real work. I see it as real work. And I think we need to start reshaping our minds around what is sex work. It is work. Whether I used to be a construction worker of all things, local 46, steamers, plumbers, get the job done. Right? And I'm not someone with the privilege of lived sex work experience, but in the same way, it's sort of similar. In construction, I'm using wrenches and cutting pipe, and I'm satisfying a client's needs according to their drawings. Or if I'm a sex worker, I'm meeting with a client, understanding what their needs are, and getting the job done. But either way, I'm making income. This becomes problematic for people who use sex work as a means of income, which is a viable means of income for trans people when they're not being hired by employers out there, when they don't have references that they can access for employment purposes. How do you prove that that you're generating income to tenants and landlords? Actually, it's a law that landlords are to evict people if they're not producing their income legally. So this becomes problematic for trans people, whose sex work is a viable and very valid form of work when it's right for them. And so without housing, now you're doing what you can to either be on the streets and get by. And sometimes it's easier for folks to use survival sex. For folks who don't know what that is, it's basically hooking up with someone and negotiating in terms of being able to sleep with them for a period of time, maybe at night, or for food or for dinner in exchange for sexual favors. And that's a means of getting housing if you can. There's also the aspect of ID when you're trying to access housing as well, that you need ID that references your identity on your applications and things like that. And that can be also difficult as a trans person. There's also costs associated with that. So I want to talk about the shelter aspect. So, okay, now you're homeless, you're trans. There's shelters. I don't need to tell you that there has been a long history of issues with trans people in the shelter system. There's reports of Visible Men, the Safer Shelter Project for FTMs, that talks about how FTM, female to male trans men, and their challenges around accessing men's shelter. And the same thing goes for trans women accessing women's shelters as well. And I encourage you to look up those studies and read those reports, because they're actually very helpful. So some of the problems within the shelter system is that you have very gendered floors, or you have a very gendered shelter. Now, I understand that legally, under a certain age, that the floors have to be gendered in the shelter system. I understand that. I know we can't work around it. But one thing that I really liked at Eden Satellite was we had this one-off room that was genderless. It was gender inclusive. It was an accessible room. And we always, we always kept it in case someone didn't quite feel comfortable on either floor. But the most important thing is that we allowed the client to self-identify for themselves. Let them choose the floor that they were most comfortable. And it was up to the shelter staff to take on the issue of educating the residents of the shelter, educating the staff around how to be trans inclusive and creating an environment that supports trans visibility and identities. But there's some issues around you know, being within a shelter system. So for someone who's homeless and a trans person, if they are in a shelter system and sex work is a viable means of work for them, there's often curfews that really don't work around the shelter system. Shelter systems usually don't see sex work as a legitimate form of work, so they won't allow you to go out and have those late nights, which essentially keeps someone in the shelter system, keeps them from moving on. And I want to also talk about, the financial barriers that trans people face. I'm not going to disclose what I've done personally with my body, but I will disclose that to date, I've probably spent roughly $50,000 to $60,000 on my trans health, something that I could have put towards an education, something I could have put towards a down payment towards a mortgage on a house, something I could have put towards increasing my level of comfort where I live. And then within trans communities, I think we need to understand, especially within the medical sphere of services, is that for trans people, before, and even HIV/AIDS research throughout the United States would support this, is that for trans people, if the health concerns of transitioning aren't addressed first, or at least addressed at the same time, everything else becomes second. Housing becomes second. Education becomes second. Employment becomes second. Healthcare beyond transitioning becomes second. And that's a concern that we all need to think about. So if our services that we're providing or environments that we're creating aren't trans positive, aren't inclusive, then we've created this additional barrier that trans people have to get over. I'm realizing I'm down to 1 minute. do I have 20 or 15?
15.
Okay. And then I also want to talk about another group of trans communities that that needs to be talked about, and it's the non-status and immigrant trans communities and trans communities of color. And again, I don't represent them, I can't speak on their behalf, but through my work, what I have observed are really scary things, like immigration officers rolling around picking up sex working trans clients and not disclosing that they're immigration officers, and then literally deporting them. So picking them up as a client or a John, and then, hey, get in the van, we're going away. And what I've seen a trend in is that trans sex workers, and particularly of color, are so underground right now that it's almost impossible to get to them. And it's hard to know where they're working and if they're supported. And there's reasons why trans people of color and trans people not of color, but regardless, immigrate or come to Canada with or without status, is because of the challenges, the social challenges that they face in their countries, and where they're not supported, where identities. I mean, it's even in Quebec that you can't change your name legally unless you go to the Supreme Court of Quebec and prove that you've had sexual reassignment surgery. Right? So there's all these barriers, even in Canada, but in other countries, it's even more challenging. So it's not uncommon. And I just want to finish up. This warrants a bigger discussion, and I encourage you to check out the other work like TransPulse that I've been a part of and get to know that work as well. And there's a workshop on that sort of talks about more of the health concerns for trans people. But I want to finish off with talking about what would help trans communities, especially homeless trans communities. So it starts right down in our own homes. It starts within our own communities. It starts within our own lines of thought, our communication, the way we talk about things, the way we approach things. We need positive literature. We do. We need to start seeing visibility. Positive visibility. That doesn't necessarily mean a poster, that doesn't necessarily mean a pride flag. We're talking about literature, written pieces, journal articles, books, children's books, cartoons, something that positively reflects trans people, so that it becomes the norm. As I sit here, I'm kind of cocky because I'm kind of like, so I'm trans, so what? I deserve the same as everyone else. Like, it doesn't matter if I rode a tricycle when I was 3 years old. It doesn't matter if I'm trans. I still should have access to everything like everyone else should. And again, it goes from like agencies. We have to have, you know, programs. We have to have it in the media. We need positive and safer spaces, especially in the shelter system. We look at this concept of gendered floors and gendered washrooms. You know, I'm proud to announce that the 519 just recently, and I would challenge everyone here in the organizations or homes, homes, because those are kind of gender inclusive already, the washrooms. But, you know, at the 519, we just made all our first floor washrooms gender inclusive. And that's it. Multi-stall, single stall. There's a picture of what's in the washroom, and that's what you know it's in there. And that would help within the shelter system. But I mean, we're talking about anti-transphobia training for staff as a starting point. There's always going to be a challenge of homophobia and transphobia amongst the residents, and I think that just that speaks to the fact that hurt people can hurt people, right? When you're marginalized, you're trying to make a space for yourself. You're sort of fighting each other, and I've seen it firsthand being a frontline worker. So we need to continue to look at things like don't ask, don't tell policies around shelter systems as well, especially for non-status and immigrant trans people and residents. And we need to look at policies that we can hold agencies and institutions accountable for, right? Because we need to have a starting point. The sad thing about usually these conversations is that people create policies and then they become, that's it. It's just words and a piece of paper and some binder on a shelf in the back room. But what really needs to happen is actions. We need to put policies into effect. We need to keep having conversations around how to engage our clients in a positive manner. So we need to continue to talk about poverty. We need to continue to talk about trans inclusion. We need to talk about the integration of trans people, not necessarily the segregation, but the integration, the normalization of trans identities and trans people. And particularly, we need to examine trans people's strengths, right? We need to start from a strength-based approach, starting where the client is as well. And we need to just strategize around the weaknesses, the areas where people need some extra help. So it's actually not that hard. And I know we can all do it, and I know many of us are doing great work, and I think we can continue to build upon what we started today. So thank you for giving me your time.
So I'm going to speak about the SHOW Clinic Harm Reduction Report that we conducted that was released in 2010, titled Drugs, Homelessness, and Health. Homeless Youth Speak Out About Harm Reduction. It was funded by the Wellesley Institute. It was conducted by SHOW Clinic, and I was the principal investigator. And the reason we did this study was we wanted to look at the current substance use, harm reduction, and sexual practice, as well as the health status of homeless street-involved youth who use very specific types of substances and living in Toronto. We wanted to identify the needs, gaps, and barriers in regards to harm reduction services, as well as other types of services and resources and advocacy for community members. We also want to advocate and influence stakeholders' responses to emerging health and social issues. And so I conducted three activities, and using a peer researcher model, so I hired and trained and supported two peer researchers who had a lived experience of homelessness and substance use and who were youth themselves. And so we did 100 survey interviews and 5 focus groups, as well as an arts-informed activity in which 4 youth created art, which reflected the themes of the study. And for the participants to participate in the study, they had to actually meet a very specific criteria. They had to be 16. Within the last 6 months, they had to be between the ages of 16 and under 25, use crack, methamphetamine, some type of non-prescribed opioid, or had injected any type of drug. And they had to be absolutely homeless, defined as living in a squat, staying in a shelter, or couch surfing. And I also formed partnerships with different community agencies across the city in order to conduct some of the activities as well as promote them. And here you can see where you can download the report as well as contact me for a presentation. I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm going to talk real fast. That I had coffee, and I don't drink coffee, so I just warn you, anything could happen today. It's a huge report. It was a really long interview, long focus groups as well, and I want to give a little snapshot around the survey respondents. So we asked about sexual orientation, and 31% identified GLBT, two-spirited, 61% identified as heterosexual, and there was 8% that either refused to answer the question or didn't know. And in regards to the GLBT, two-spirited youth, we asked about their current gender identity. We asked everyone this question, but here's the breakdown of this group. We see 20 people identify as male, 7 female, and 4 transgender or transsexual. And we also screened all the youth to make sure that they actually met the eligibility requirement. And so this is a bit of a breakdown of how GLBT, two-spirited youth, answered the screening question regarding their substance use in the past 6 months. So So you see 19 had used crack, 23 had used methamphetamine, 11 had used some type of opioid, and 11 had injected some type of drug. There's a lot of crossover, meaning people who use crack also use meth, people injected also use opiates, and so on. I would say the big difference between youth who identified as heterosexual versus those who identified as queer was that we actually saw higher crack use rather than higher methamphetamine use. So that was the big difference. We also asked things about high school. So we found within, so the stats I'm going to give are really specifically around queer-identified youth. So we saw that 81% didn't finish high school. We know when we look at the determinants of health, education is a big factor. We also saw that there was incredible levels of poverty, and the two main sources of income was panhandling and illegal activities, followed by, you know, OW and ODSP. And, you know, so youth really relied on a wide variety of income sources, and that's really created a lot of stress for them, and there was also lots of stigma attached to some of the activities that they engaged in. So some overarching conclusions is that homeless youth run the same risk as adults who use substances, with the exception that their age actually adds some extra vulnerability. We also see that this lack of stability, consistency in all areas of their lives builds and adds to the overall precariousness of their situation. And it really affects their ability to move forward, establish stability in any one area. It's hampered by the stress emanating from another one. And social stigma needs to be addressed. So both Michelle and Alona talked about social stigma, and for the youth who participated in the study, they experienced stigma for a variety of reasons that have already been spoken about, but also due to issues of racism and homelessness and poverty and source of income and mental and physical health conditions. But I want to talk a little bit about the stigma attached to substance use, both the types of drugs youth use and the methods of drug use. So we asked youth about what were their perceptions of other people's attitudes about them as homeless, street-involved drug users, and I want to share some quotes with you. This is what the youth said to us. We're no good, street trash, we should all be in jail. Scum of the earth, everyone has human rights, but we're drug addicts and we don't have shit. Not trustworthy, not respectful. They think you've made your bed. You're stupid, dirty, useless. So imagine waking up every day and that's what you think other people think about you. What would the impact be? I'll tell you what the youth told us it would be. It created poor self-image, poor self-esteem and self-care, and increased risk-taking behaviors. And they had difficulty forming trusting relationships and opening up and self-disclosure. And there was a reluctance to seek out support from professionals. And there was a tremendous sense of hopelessness and despair, as well as internalized negative stereotypes. And some hardened themselves against the discrimination, and they met by trying not to care what other people thought about them, and by isolating themselves. And I want to share some quotes with you. It makes me angry if I start to think of a worker thinks negatively. They're supposed to be open-minded and respectful. It's kind of degrading. It makes you kind of angry. We don't want society or the community to look down on us, so we don't reach out for help. And one young man talked about this, and I thought it was really quite brave of him to do this in a focus group. There should be more info telling guys it's okay to tell people they were sexually assaulted or raped, but how people are grown up is guys don't talk about that shit. So some other conclusions: that it's crucial to provide public health services geared to this vulnerable population of youth, and that protecting youth with harm reduction services rather than punishing them should be the priority of future programs. I'm going to run out of time, I can sense it. So I want to talk a little bit about homelessness. So it's really important to notice that 45% of these youth had experienced homelessness before their 16th birthday, and many of them had long histories of homelessness. And the youth talked about the difficulty they had coping with homelessness and staying in shelters and just really struggling to survive on a daily basis. So it's no wonder that a very, very large portion of them use drugs to cope with homelessness and to stay up all night and to cope with even staying in a shelter. And they relied on a wide range of sources of shelter, some safe, some very unsafe and very unstable. And it was kind of reflective of where they did drugs as well, and it really influenced some of the drug choices. And so some stayed in youth shelters, some stayed with partners and girlfriends and acquaintances, some occasionally had places they rented on their own, but a good portion of them also stayed in streets and alleyways and parks and squats and abandoned buildings and under bridges and stairwells. And correctional facilities also made up a large source of shelter, and that breaks my heart when I hear that. And things that were different, again, between queer-identified youth and straight-identified youth was that queer youth relied on bathhouses more for shelter and client sex partners. And again, you know, homelessness influenced their drug choices. We found that youth staying on the streets were more apt to use stimulants and alcohol, and it really talks about the nature of survival. And here's another wonderful quote. "I would do ecstasy so I could stay up all night and be warm and functional, not rolled up in a ball in the middle of winter, and at least I'd be walking around, have energy, and be with friends." And at some point or another, all youth use drugs in some type of outdoor location or a public place like a bar, a bathroom, or a bathhouse, as well as community-based agencies and correctional facilities. And a fair amount of youth who injected drugs did so while in jail. And we all know that prisons have no needle exchange programs. And the youth had difficulty finding and maintaining housing. And a lot of youth, whether they were housed or homeless, had a lot of safety issues. And there was a wide range of them around verbal abuse, exposure, police harassment, and violence. And again, we found that a lot of youth use drugs in order to feel safe. So when we talk about difficulty finding and maintaining housing, it's for all the reasons that you would imagine. A lot of it had to do with poverty. Sometimes it's the impact of substance use and binging. Some was around discrimination, both as drug users, as young people, and as people who are homeless, and just the lack of affordable and appropriate housing. And also just instability. So for some of the youth, almost half of them had been imprisoned at some point in the past year. And for many of them, it was more than just one trip to an incarceration. And for many of them, it was stays longer than a week. So I want to talk a little bit about drug use and related harms and risks. So what we found was, again, what you'd expect from young people, wide range of drug use, stimulants, where probably, So in terms of the most common drugs that have been used in the past 6 months, there aren't really many surprises. You got alcohol, cannabis, ecstasy, methamphetamine, cocaine, crack, ketamine, acid and mushrooms, a wide range of opiates, poppers, benzodiazepines were kind of those big ones, with stimulants being probably the drug of choice. And it's really important to know that the age of initiation to drug use was for many of the youth way before their 16th birthday, and for some it was as young as 10 years. And so we really know that both prevention, education, access to harm reduction resources really needs to start happening at a much earlier age if we want to prevent some of the risk and harms that can happen. And again, there was a wide range of methods of use, smoking with pint, orally, snorting, injecting. Very, very small amount of people were doing anal suppositories. I'm going to talk a little bit about the harms because I think sometimes we're really running out of time. So lots of drug sharing of equipment, both in terms of snorting equipment, needles, and crack and methamphetamine pipes. And some of this drug sharing was to do with a lack of access to harm reduction supplies. Some of it had to do with trusting the people who were part of your social network. Some of it had to do with where you were using, and also just the nature of binging. We also saw unhygienic injections, needing help to inject, unsafe disposal of used injection equipment. And again, some of this has to do with where they're using drugs and a lack of knowledge and experience. And again, probably drug use and overdoses. I'm just going to try to find where this is. About 33% of youth had overdosed in the past 6 months, with many of them needing medical intervention. And again,
with people who are using methamphetamine and smoking crack, we see a really, really high use of homemade and toxic pipes. And we know these to be an increased risk for hep C and HIV. A lot of it has to do with trauma to the lips and hands and mouth area and what these pipes are made of. And they're made of things that, you know, are often, you know, sharp pieces of glass and metal. And the report goes into much more detail around some of these issues. We also see a really high rates of drug-induced psychosis, paranoid delusions, and hallucinations. And some of it has to do with tolerance and binging. And some of it has to do with pre-existing health conditions, mental health conditions, and the combination of those situations. And again, unprotected sex, often related to... Oh, my mic's out again. Mm-hmm. Well, I may just have... You know, I don't know what to do. It's died on me. But I'm pretty loud. Everyone can hear me, right? Yeah, okay. And we all know about that. I'm going to really just breeze through some health issues. So we saw that amongst the youth we interviewed, there were some significant health issues with them being respiratory illnesses. If this is not working, I don't want to hold it. I'm going to put it down. So we saw a lot of learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, respiratory illnesses, chronic pain issues, sleep issues, poor diet, sexually transmitted infections, exhaustion. We also saw a real lack of access to healthcare. So you can see a large portion had difficulties. And we see really high rates of mental health issues and trauma. So about 26 reported they had some type of mental health condition. We also asked them how to report, you know, to self-rate their physical health. And it's no surprise that more than half of them rated as fair to poor. And they rated their mental health as being 66 as being fair to poor, and really high rates of daily stress. And again, it's no wonder that youth reported using drugs both to cope with mental health symptoms and conditions, to feel healthier, to cope with pain, and to deal with trauma issues, and to cope with loneliness and boredom, and to really escape and disconnect. We saw really high rates of trauma and assaults. And also, those who had been assaulted, 89% of them had never received any medical or emotional support. So we see trauma issues really going unaddressed. We saw lots of negative interactions with police and individual police officers, resulting in physical assaults and threats and harassment. Some of these in the forms of transphobia and homophobia. And again, lots of barriers to receiving support. And around dependency and addiction, give me my last point here, about 66% were unsuccessful when they attempted to either cut down or quit their drug of choice. And almost half had used drugs to really cope with withdrawal symptoms. And very, very little access to mental health, counseling, and drug treatment services. So why is this? Well, there's numerous barriers, and I'm going to try to do this all in 2 minutes. So this is a great quote. I love this quote. It really talks about so many things. I wanted to quit, but growing up and not being anything, you don't think you can do it because you've been beaten down by words so much that's like, what's the point, right? So we see that they experienced a wide range of barriers. Some of these relate to policy, things like zero tolerance, policies, restrictive eligibility criteria, and a real absence both from the federal and local levels around adopting a four-pillar approach to drug use. Around structural barriers, these are all around access, you know, to services, around hours, locations, transportation, you know, waiting times, waiting lists, referrals, and intake process. And again, lack of trust and support and service coordination and continuity. You see attitudinal barriers. And they really block youth are very fearful of being outed, being judged and labeled, and talks about social stigma and discrimination, but also the nature of social networks. They also have both a positive and negative impact around youth's access of services. And we see knowledge barriers. Some is around knowledge of services and how they work, and some it's around knowledge of risk and the concept of risk and the things that minimize perception of risk, and then complex and multidimensional. And we're talking about the nature of homelessness and instability, and One common example would be lack of consistent discharge planning, the lack of support around transitioning from youth sector into the adult sector. And for many youth, this is where they really start to fall through the cracks and start to lose ground around the pieces of work they've done. And then you also have fair police, and fair police has many, many impacts on youth. So we talk about recommendations. We want to see an adoption of a harm reduction approach. Almost 90% of all youth agreed with this. They want to see options and choices of programs and services and a wide range, and the report goes into details about that, and responsive and comprehensive and flexible services. So really that one-stop shopping kind of model and what we call low threshold program development. Friendly faces and friendly places, and it's around how do you make your agency welcome to youth who use drugs. And again, peer workers and staff with lived experiences. And youth speak out about receiving respect and fair treatment, about target social stigma, and about treatment instead of jail, and about bringing the police on board. And I would love to go into more detail, but I don't have time. But again, if you go into the report, you'll see these broken down into actual different service sectors and secure funding. And some really specific ones around harm reduction. As you can see, the ones I really want to really talk about is providing supplies that youth need and will use. So expanding what we have, but building on what we have. We need safer meth kits, similar to the crack kit, safer snoring kits, and safer drug testing kits. And we also need to see safe place to use. A lot of the youth want to see safe injection and consumption sites for health and safety issues. And last but not least, Shout did a report many years ago with queer youth, and these are some of the key messages that I think are still relevant to the report I'm presenting today. And again, I think, whoops, we're done. Computer says no. So I want to thank you for listening to all that.